I think I should wait a couple of minutes, maybe. I have a little kind of an announcement to make, but I think I want to wait till more of the people are here. So maybe we will let Miss Baker start. But first of all, is everybody here who's not on the policy committee? I know Doug isn't on the policy committee. Scott isn't. There's somebody else.
Who?
Oh, and Ruth Johnson either, and she's not here yet. So I kind of hate to start without the people that haven't heard more about this before. Assuming that they're going to show up soon, we won't wait too long, but I'll wait a couple more minutes. Okay.
Is there a door in this room? We can start.
In the meantime, this is for a celebration. So...
Well, I think Valerie's expecting today that was so good. So good for the punch.
Yes, give it. You can have some empty calories instead. In the meantime, it just happens that Gay Crow's daughter is selling Girl Scout cookies. If there's anybody desperate to buy Girl Scout cookies.
How did you get that?
And the first item of business was to thank Valerie Dosland for her years of service here. I feel like you've been here as long as I have, Valerie, but maybe it wasn't quite that long, huh?
I've been here 8 years.
8 years. Okay, so my first term when I didn't know which direction I was going, I probably wouldn't have realized whether you were or were not here. But I know once they created the Early Childhood Committee, which I served on my second term, third and fourth terms here, Valerie was the Democrat committee staff for that committee. She was always the staff that was attending the meetings and also the person that we'd have some meetings where, you know, she would actually attend. She and when I was chair, the lead Democrat and Valerie would attend the meetings. That was Mary Jo McGuire back then. And so we would... So I've had a lot of opportunity to work with Valerie. She's always been pretty upfront and nice to work with, even though I know she's put you up to no good a few times. But in general, I mean that sincerely. She's been fair and above board, and I've appreciated that. And on behalf of a little celebration for Valerie, we'll pass this box this way, and this box the other way. And Brett, I think you should take that box to Valerie for first choice. And there was a card presented this morning, which I think most of us had an opportunity to sign. So thank you very much, Valerie, for all your years of service. Good luck. We're not going to ask you to speak. But we wish you well in what you're going on to do. So thank you very much.
Good.
So we'll go on now.
Madam Chair.
Marilyn Baker back again. Yes.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just kind of tailgate on your comments. It was suggested to me that at this meeting, as the DFL policy lead, that at this time it was my turn to embarrass Valerie a little bit. So, but I won't ask her to speak, and I will say, you know, first of all, I think that for all of us, you know, over and over again, we wish we would even say more often how much all of the staff is of value to us. We always seem to say it at the end of session to a few people, but I think we all realize when we've been here long enough that we get help from all the staff, and that oftentimes the staff from the other side of the aisle can be very beneficial, well, certainly to the process, but sometimes we end up working together more than we ever thought, and I've had those good experiences here as well. I told Ms. Dozeland that I, for one, was not accepting this easily in terms of her leaving, that I would make it as difficult as possible, and assured her that once she left, it gets harder and harder. It will be harder and harder to even remember her, but I also... I also told Veronica whoever it is, there's a price to pay for leaving us. And,
oh, yeah, that gal that used to work with
you. Yeah, you know who I mean. But that didn't seem to help. And so I guess, it's good then to say thank you and farewell. And good luck.
So, Representative Dorn, would you say we're making the exit pleasant doing this or tougher?
I was hoping it was too tough, but I don't think I'm able to do that. So,
thank you.
A gracious farewell.
And, you know, this morning we had Marilyn Baker to talk about the TAP program. We're going to review just very briefly some of the policy parts of the TAP program that we discussed this morning, and then go on to some of the other implications of the program. Go ahead, Ms. Baker.
Hi again. First of all, as you can see, I did go back to my office and get my technology working, and so you will have the PowerPoint and I did amend it as well. I spoke with Representative Sikora, and we decided that I will amend this part of my presentation to slant it more toward education finance, since this is the Education Finance Committee. So, first of all, my email address is there, so if anybody has questions after today that they wish to email to me, I am very good at responding, usually within 24 hours, or at least that's my goal. So, I'm going to run through some of the real basics of the teacher advancement program. One of the things that I mentioned this morning and didn't have a PowerPoint to really help you to see is the difference in student achievement based on 3 years with an effective teacher and 3 years without an effective teacher. Mm. This is research that comes out of Tennessee. It was done by Alan Saunders, who is the person who was developed the value-added system. And so that was the slide that I was referring to. And the whole purpose of it is, why have a program like TAP? Why is it so important that we have effective ways to teach teachers instructional strategies that really make a difference? Well, as you can see, there's a 54 percentile difference in achievement with these different teachers. This was the June Rivers study that I referred to. Again, Effective versus ineffective teachers make a huge difference in the academic achievement of our students. We also have to, though, be aware that any program that we put into place has got to really help teachers to feel valued and to feel as though they are being helped and professionally developed, because we have a huge problem with teachers leaving. 20% of teachers overall are gone within 3 years. 50% of urban teachers are gone within 5 years. If there are no effective professional development programs for teachers, they're twice as likely to leave the teaching profession. And they're also the ones, unfortunately, the teachers with our highest scores on high-stakes exams are the ones that are most likely to leave for other professions.
Ms. Baker, so we have a question from Representative Dorn. Go ahead.
Oops, your mouth is full. The dangers of donuts.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to follow the Senate's lead from the story I read about Senator Tomasoni. If you saw that, I don't know if you saw that story or not, coming back from the state of the state, he ended up talking with food in his mouth, and Senator Metzen had to apply the Heimlich maneuver. So it was quite serious, but I don't want to get caught in that situation. I didn't know, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, if you wanted questions now or at the end or as we're going through.
Yeah, Ms. Baker, I'll defer to you. How would you prefer to take questions, as they come or at the end of your presentation?
I'm comfortable either way. However you want to do it.
As they go, then.
Okay.
I think it makes more sense.
Right, and then people don't have to kind of go back to previous information.
Well, the one question was, because I know you used the words effective and ineffective in this morning's presentation, and I wondered about those terms because it seemed like such a stark contrast of either or, and yet the rest of your comments seemed to be that there was a wide range of ability, and if you had some who you then said there might be a few who were horrible, but there really were people at different stages. But I see, again, you're using the terms effective and ineffective. And is there some definition that they used in terms of that, or did they just simply say a teacher who happened to have students who scored at such and such a level was thereby defined as being ineffective? Where did the terms come from, and what do they mean?
This is the Sanders study from Tennessee, and they define their effective and ineffective teachers based on the value-added kinds of gains that they saw and then followed those teachers. And you're absolutely right. This was kind of comparing some of the low-end teachers with some of the higher-end teachers in terms of those measures. But you're absolutely right. Teachers are all across the board. And when I say effective and ineffective, I'm not talking about the person. I'm talking about the instructional practice. And therefore, instructional practices can be taught, and all teachers at whatever level they're at can then move forward.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Dorn.
And thank you for that answer. The question, just even on the slide you're on now, one of the concerns that I registered in a previous meeting, and something in the same order, is just what is the Minnesota data for some of the things we're looking at? Do we know what numbers of teachers have left in Minnesota, and do we have any indication as to the range of reasons for that departure? Was it at all connected to effectiveness, or was it the inability to be effective rather than not being effective? I think there's a difference in my mind there. Just what do we know about the Minnesota situation?
What we know about the Minnesota situation is that it's fairly similar to the national data. 20-30% of all new teachers Minnesota-wide are leaving within the first 3 years, and 40-50% of the teachers in urban areas are leaving within the first 5 years. And that, so the national data does reflect Minnesota fairly closely.
And do we have a breakdown of the reasons for the departure? Do we have any sort of information as to why that's going on?
There are a variety of reasons why. I'm sorry. There are a variety of reasons why. Some of it is that people get into the teaching profession, and as happened with me on my first day of teaching. I was given the key to my classroom, a hearty handshake, and a good luck. And so what happens is that this business of teaching is getting very, very, very difficult. And one of the other components of the teacher advancement, the teacher quality grant that the state is working on is a quality 3-year mentor program for teachers. So I know that one of the reasons that teachers leave is that they don't feel they get the support and professional development and help that they need to deal with very difficult situations and very high stakes, because everything's in the paper. And I think that under those kind of pressures, people need to be apprentices for a while. And I know that doesn't happen for a lot of new teachers in an effective way.
Representative Gemmer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dorn brings up an issue that I was going to talk about. I think there's a reason for leaving. And you talk about 20% of all teachers within 3 years and 50% of urban teachers in 5 years. And I'm thinking in the rural setting, I was just visiting with Representative Klinzing about, in the school that I'm from, it seems like we have longevity. And it's a smaller rural school, and we have a lot of people staying. And it's that way with a lot of the schools that I'm around there. Changing somewhat with demographics and people living in different places. But do you have any data on rural schools and their turnover?
I don't have that with me today, but if you email me, I can get somebody to get that for you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I think we'd all be interested in seeing that. So if you will just send it to Brett, our committee administrator, Brett Walsh, and he will make sure we all get it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Representative Secord. I just as a comment, I think it'll be good information. I might say something about the culture, and again, looking back to how we want, that might be a better one for actually the Education Reform, Policy and Reform Committee, but I guess something about the culture we have in our education, and look at the results we have with our rural schools and the lack of turnover maybe compared to urban. I think there's a bigger lesson in there for us. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, now I will talk very briefly. I know many of you were here this morning, but I do want to just review the major components of the TAP program. The first component I want to talk about is multiple career paths. And for those of you here this morning, again, my apologies, but multiple career paths within TAP allow teachers to progress and to be promoted without leaving the teaching profession for administration and without leaving the classroom. Within the TAP program, there are three levels. The career teacher, which is our absolutely heart and soul of all schools. That's our classroom teachers and all the other teachers that are in the school. The next, but within TAP, given excellent instructional strategies and an interview process and a posting within schools, people are selected to become either mentor teachers or master teachers within the school. At each of those levels, there is additional responsibility, additional authority, and additional compensation. And all of the teachers continue to teach in the classroom for part of the day, and our coaches within classrooms for fellow teachers. Also, the master teachers are the primary people in charge of... I don't know if this is... Is it better for me to use my playground voice?
No.
Okay. This is my old principal voice.
You just don't have to be quite as close to it. I think it's opening you up pretty well.
Okay, thank you. Additional responsibility authority. It is also the master teacher's responsibility to research the school data and to look at the needs of the children and then to closely align the professional development for teachers with the needs in the school, the needs at the grade level, and also with the needs of the individual teachers within each cluster group. Along with multiple career paths, the TAP model has performance and responsibility driving compensation. As you know, the governor is proposing that we consider other ways to pay teachers besides steps and lanes, which is the steps and lanes is the system that teachers have been paid since about 1950. And in that system, your salary is tied to how many years you've been in the district and how many degrees or other forms of professional development that you've gotten. Within the TAP program, salary enhancements are based on three things. One, it's based on your performance in the classroom, and you have multiple evaluations during the year. In a TAP program, teachers are often evaluated 5 to 6 times in any given school year with follow-up coaching and follow-up evaluation and feedback. The other way that you can earn additional compensation is through the increased achievement of the students in your own class, and the third way is through the increased achievement of the school as a whole. So there's both a team effort and an individual effort toward improving student achievement. The within the TAP model, there is instructionally focused accountability. I mentioned that teachers are evaluated 5 to 6 times a year. Those evaluations are done by mentor teachers, master teachers, and principals, so it isn't just one person. And all people doing a TAP evaluation have to be certified and trained to do so. Also within the school, there needs to be agreement as to what everybody's looking at, and inter-rater reliability has to be proven within the school. Within the TAP program, then, there are specific standards for effective instruction, and these rubrics are well researched and common throughout the country in terms of what elements of instruction are being evaluated. Hiring, advancement, and compensation are all tied to the evaluation of your instructional practice. So as a teacher, you would be observed and your instructional practice would be evaluated as a way for you to take on a mentor or a master position. And finally, there is a tremendous amount of support provided for growth. I mentioned this morning, the question for me is not, are you a good teacher? We have a huge number of good teachers in Minnesota. The question is, can you be an even better teacher? And this is a program that helps everybody at whatever level they're at, either a new teacher or a 20-year veteran, to be an even better teacher. The final component, or essential element of TAP, is the ongoing applied professional growth. This is the cornerstone. I'm a huge believer that you can't expect people to get better unless you give them the means to get better. If they're going to improve as a teacher, they have to have specific professional growth. And according to the Beverly Showers research, it has to be targeted, and it has to give a person a chance to practice it, and it has to be followed in the classroom with coaching and feedback. And that is what the TAP model is all about. All of the cluster meetings where these professional development groups that take place are based on data. They take a look at what the state standards are, and they're tied to each school's improvement plan. And this is the key. When a teacher comes to cluster group, the instructional strategy that is being developed is related to the needs of the kids. The teacher, right within the cluster group, is not just given instruction on what this method is about, but they are given opportunities right within the cluster group to develop the lesson plan, get feedback on the lesson plan, and then go back to the classroom. And once they go back to the classroom, they can have all kinds of levels of support. They could have the mentor teacher come and teach it right to their own students. For some teachers, that's a really powerful thing because many teachers say, well, this is fine here in cluster group, but wait till you see my kids. So to have that actually go back into the classroom with the teacher's own students makes it a very powerful way to help them learn it. They also could have a team taught, or they could teach it themselves and get feedback and coaching. Those are the four essential elements of the program. What I wanted to talk on with this committee about, which we didn't talk about this morning, is a little bit about what does it cost to implement the TAP program effectively. Nationally, TAP is being implemented at the cost of about $200 to $400 per student. As of this fall, there were 72 TAP schools across the country. TAP program, which was developed by the Milk and Family Foundation, recommends that in order to really effectively implement TAP, it would cost about $400 per student. And Deputy Commissioner Anderson says that in terms of current school funding, that's about 6% of Minnesota budgets for implementation. As you know, Waseca is one of the school districts that has implemented TAP, and they have implemented it at $400 per student. All of the funding in Waseca for implementing this came from a federal grant, a Title II higher ed grant, and that funding was a three-year grant, and it's part of a study to compare alternative compensation sites with non-alternative compensation sites in terms of student achievement. Now, how could TAP be funded in Minnesota? Well, certainly the 2% set aside of staff development funds is one source of funding. Title II funds within a district is a source of funding. And I think a lot of people are looking at the governor's proposal, which is, according to the governor's proposal for alternative compensation, there would be approximately $225 per student for alternative comp programs that include all of the elements of TAP. And we've just gone through those elements, the multiple career path, the multiple evaluations by multiple people, the ongoing applied professional development, et cetera. How this plays out is that with all of those sources of funding, schools could come up with $400 per student together. Now, I did mention this morning that TAP, the success of TAP is being measured and tracked by the Milken Family Foundation through two ways. One is through increased student achievement, and there are early results that show TAP schools are outperforming similar schools that don't have the TAP program.
Ms. Baker, before you go any further on the performance, Representative Clinzing has a question, followed by Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Baker, I was wondering when you were talking about the $400 cost per student, what do those costs pay for? What do they buy? And kind of, you know, what's the breakdown of percentage-wise of all the things they cover? Is it 50% administration and, you know, 50% rewards to the teachers? Or how does that break out?
Okay, Ms. Baker.
The way the costs break down for TAP is that there is a certain amount of the TAP budget that goes toward the bonuses that TAP right now in the country is over and above steps and lanes. And so additional compensation is all in the form of bonuses. The biggest cost in this $400 per student comes from the bonuses that each teacher earns, again, based on those three things, their evaluation, their student gains, and the school's student gains. Now, if a district were to restructure its salary schedule in some way, those bonuses could replace or be a part of the step. Therefore, all of that funding might not be necessary for bonuses over and above the salary schedule. So the biggest cost is the bonuses. The second biggest cost is that master teachers have to be hired at a ratio of approximately 18 to 20 teachers per master teacher. Now, although these are full-time teachers in the school, they also teach at least one class a day of their own students. And so the cost of the salaries for master teachers is the next biggest cost in TAP. The third cost is that there may need to be some way to restructure the school day. In some cases, they have substitute teachers. In some cases, they schedule the cluster meetings right into the school day. But there may need to be additional money, say, for example, to buy an additional art teacher, so that when the teachers are in cluster meetings, their students are receiving excellent instruction, and they're not just, you know, in study hall while the teachers are meeting. Because the way the TAP program is structured, the cluster meetings are to be a part of the teacher's regular work day. They're not an add-on. They're not on weekends. They're not after a tiring day of teaching, you know, 150 kids. So those would be the major costs.
Follow-up.
Representative Clinzing.
Thank you. I guess I wasn't aware at first that the master teachers weren't in the classroom all day. And so you said they teach at least one. Can they teach more than one class per day?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of on average, the master teachers, that is, and on average, how many do they teach that you've seen? I mean, what's kind of the breaking point at which they feel, I can't be a master teacher and keep, I mean, I'm all for, I really do think it's very hard to critique teachers and review teachers if you yourself are not in the classroom still teaching at that time. But I just kind of some more information on the feedback from teachers about that particular job balance.
Ms. Baker.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The master teacher job is a tremendous, tremendous responsibility. One class a day is, some of the master teachers in the program teach one class a day. Some of the master teachers teach two classes a day. Nobody can do the job and teach more than two classes a day. But that doesn't mean they're not in classrooms more than that, because they're still out, you know, demo teaching in classrooms from some of the other teachers. They're still out working with the teachers in a coaching fashion, and so they're in the classroom and they're helping the teacher, him or herself, to learn the better practices. So it means they're in classrooms more than one or two periods a day, but one or two periods a day is really the max.
Okay, and last quick follow-up.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you. So you mentioned the two top costs are the bonuses and then the master teachers, and then what are the other costs to implementing besides those two items?
Well, there would be, however you are, if you're going to free a group of 6 to 8 teachers to meet in a cluster, you either have to have additional specialists within the school in order to have the children be with instructors during that time. Sometimes it is done with a cadre of trained substitute teachers that would go like an hour and a half, and each teacher would only be out of his or her classroom for an hour and a half, but there are costs associated with that. And that's pretty much it.
Ms. Baker, don't the mentor teachers get paid additional costs?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. There's the salary augmentation for both master and mentor teachers. And again, as I mentioned, as you climb the career ladder, you take on more authority, more responsibility, and you get additional compensation.
Another follow-up, Representative Klinzing.
Well, I was expecting you, Ms. Baker, to get to the cost of maybe what you and your assistant might be to this program. Like, because I think right now you might be funded by a federal grant, but if someone would need to take on your position in the school or another region of the state, you may not be able to handle it if, you know, enough districts signed up to do this. I mean, I would think that would be part of the cost or the extra implementation cost. Am I wrong? Or
my particular salary is actually an in-kind contribution by the Milken Family Foundation, and so it's no cost to the state or the grant. If a school district wants to do the teacher advancement program, the actual copyrighted full program, the cost for my help is picked up through there. The assistant that I spoke of will be paid for through Title II funding.
Ms. Baker, is there any additional training provided by the Milken Foundation at the sites?
Yes. Every school that becomes a full-fledged TAP school goes through a series of 8 days, 8 full days of training that has been developed by the Milken Family Foundation. It comes in 2-day blocks. It's 2 days, go back and do some practice, and so on and so forth. So there is specific training for both how cluster groups need to operate, how to do data-driven cluster group topics, and then 4 days of how to become a certified TAP evaluator within the school.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. We also have a question from Representative Dabney.
I'll pass, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I still have, you did a very good job in explaining the cost end of it and where the money comes from. I still have a hard time, I don't know if I'm following you right on it, when you pay out, is it just for individual teachers, or is there a component in there for a team effort for the site base as well?
The component on the payout is each individual teacher gets his or her own bonus based on 3 things. Their evaluations, those 5 evaluations during the school year. Their students, their own students' gains in reading and math, and as the MCA goes to cover science, it would be science as well. And then the whole school gains. And so, as I said, there is a team effort in it, but there's also an individual effort in it.
That's it. Go ahead.
Okay. So within the governor's proposal, which we talked about this morning, I believe that he calls it QComp for Quality Comp. is the proposal is that all of the elements of TAP would be in this alternative compensation program, and districts that chose to do it would want to be looking at ways to build it into their salary schedule in some way, shape, or form. If that were to be done, then some of the funding right within all of your human resources costs could also be used to implement the TAP program. I mentioned that, and I see this thing as being a little... Okay, I mentioned that one of the things about any new program is it's got to resonate with the professionals who are doing it. It's got to not, it's got to, it can't be a threatening kind of a thing. It's got to be a supportive kind of a thing. And so TAP has measured, and when I say TAP, I mean the Milken Family Foundation, surveys teachers each spring who are in TAP schools to say, what is it that you think about this program? And these are some of the things that they did share. The teachers themselves have shared with the Milken Family Foundation about the program. New teacher support is much, much more thorough and comprehensive than it had ever been. Sometimes veteran teachers find out about TAP and they want to move to the schools where TAP is being implemented because they find it to be professionally challenging to enter into a program like this. Teachers are reporting that they're actually more collaborative than they have ever been. If there are weekly cluster meetings when teachers get together professionally and look at their professional practice, you can well imagine how much better that is than running across each other in the teacher lounge. So they are reporting much, much. That is actually the strongest finding from the surveys that Milken has put out, is that collaboration and communication among teachers has improved. They're seeing flexibility and change in the classroom practices. I can testify to that from firsthand experience because I have worked in some of the schools already, and we have done some cluster meetings and followed teachers to the classroom and seen changes in instructional practice. When the teachers begin to study the rubrics, one of the things we do in the schools is we start by showing them videotapes of teachers teaching. And then the teachers themselves use the rubric to score or evaluate the teaching episode. In this way, they begin to truly understand what's expected of them and what the rubric means. And so then, when they go back to their own classrooms, they have clear expectations regarding their own performance. That's been very helpful for teachers. The immediate feedback is another real key and important part that teachers, again, all of these statements are coming out of teachers' own words in the surveys that are done. The immediate feedback is so key and critical. They have a follow-up conference with whoever has done their evaluation within 48 hours max of when the teaching was observed, and they get very specific steps and feedback for how to improve in one area only. It's called a refinement area in the TAP model. Rather than trying to say, okay, here's the 15 areas that you're being evaluated in, and here's how you get better, 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 one area is selected, a specific model is developed for the teacher to improve in that area, and guided practice is provided so they can immediately go to how can I improve in this particular area of my own refinement.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Baker, how closely might what you're describing parallel with the Madeline Hunter model that I trained and used for years?
Well, I also have extensive training in the Madeline Hunter model, and I have to tell you there are a lot of parallels. There are some things that no matter what you teach, that no matter what grade level, whether it's a special education student or an ELL student, and having been in numerous kinds of classrooms over the years, I know this is true. There are certain kinds of things that are just key and critical. What is your objective? How clearly do you know exactly what it is you're going to teach your kids and why? That's on the rubric. How are you going to go about teaching that? How are you going to group your students? How are you going to make sure you get active learning? I mean, these are the kinds of things on the rubric which you will recognize from Madeline Hunter. But also, a lot of this rubric was based on Charlotte Danielson's work, and that also is very nationally known to be appropriate to evaluating teaching.
Representative Erickson.
Ms. Baker, are those of us who are no longer in the classroom eligible to take the TAP? training and become involved in this?
Ms. Baker, I feel like we had that question before.
It's not open to the general public. I'm just going to say that. It is excellent training. I absolutely loved it.
You know, it just so happens that somebody sent me a tape, and I watched it last night. It was from Brainerd School District, and it was on a mentoring program that they'd set up for new teachers. And having heard all the statistics on the turnover, since they've been using this, their teacher retention is over 90% since they've been using this new program that they have developed themselves. So I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for teacher development, support, et cetera. Obviously, it's making a difference.
Right.
So then they compared it to surrounding districts and what was happening there, and it was a world of difference. But anyway, go on with your presentation.
Well, that actually is my last slide, I guess at this point in time, what I would say is that if people are interested in knowing more about the specifics of the TAP program, the Milken Family Foundation has a website, and all of the data that they have collected about the program, both the teacher satisfaction data and the student achievement data, are on the website, and that website is MFF, for Milken Family Foundation, MFF.org. So that I also have tons of stuff in my office that I could share with people if they would like additional information about the program and if there are any other questions.
Ms. Baker, why don't we go through, we have a draft in your files.
Thank you.
To the presentation is also a draft of what we may do in Waseca. And this is, you know, what has been suggested by the Waseca people. But why don't you take a look at it? It would, we would observe, one of the first things we would do is observe a cluster meeting, because you've heard a lot about the cluster groups. And I think you need to see a cluster meeting and see kind of what they do in a cluster group. And we, since there's going to be probably, if most of us go, about 40 of us, we will break up into two groups, so we're not an overwhelming presence to anybody that we visit. But then we'll get a chance to talk with the teachers. I really wanted you to have a lot of opportunity to do that. Principals, master teachers, mentor teachers, career teachers, etc. And that will be over lunch. And I'll just tell you that there will be a lunch provided for which you will pay. Since per diem means that the committee can't buy you lunch, you have to buy your own. Sorry about that. And then the panel discussion. And at 1:30 time there, they have a little charter school that they've also started in Waseca. I thought as long as we're there, we might as well visit the charter school. However, I think I'll see if at the same time as that, if we can't, maybe some of us have an opportunity to observe some of the teachers in the TAP program as well, and maybe go to one of the charter grades and one class or something like that. I'd like to see a classroom. So maybe we can squeeze that in too, even if we have to leave a little after 2:30. Are you all okay with that? We're talking about leaving here at 8. That was deleted from the program. If you arrive at 9:30, it's over, folks. You will have missed the bus. We are leaving here promptly at 8, and it'll take us about an hour and a half. And then you'll get back here sometime, I would say, between 4 and 4:30. So it will be a full day. I think you will find it a pretty interesting day, and you'll get a chance to ask questions directly of people who are working in the program rather than hearing it from other people who have just been observing. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding the process of getting a grant to the TAP program. Is this the appropriate time to ask about that?
Why not?
Okay, well, good.
Ms. Baker.
And my question is, I have a school district that they just, in the last week, four out of the five schools in that district, the teachers approved alternative compensation program.
Really, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I've been out there a lot.
Okay, great. So now where do we go from here? And do they have to have all five pass? Or is it okay to go forward with four? And will they get some money to implement this? I mean, that type of thing. What's the next process?
Ms. Baker.
Thank you. The schools that are doing it now have, as I said, they've been funded through a teacher quality enhancement grant. And that grant is expensive. Excuse me. It's gone.
What Fridley and other districts now that might want to look at this would be using the, again, hopefully if some of these funds are approved, would be using some of the alternative compensation funding that's in the governor's proposal to put it into effect. That would mean that it wouldn't be tied to a grant which expires, but it would be long-term funding for school districts that are able to find a way to use that $225 plus, you know, perhaps look at a salary, look at it, the bonuses, you know, adding to or replacing steps, plus their own Title II funding and their own staff development funding to get up to the $400 per student. So districts henceforth that want to implement TAP, including Fridley, and they are moving forward to implement it, would be looking at longer-term funding rather than just during the period of the grant. As far as whether individual schools could do it within districts, that's happening in Minneapolis. They have three fully implementing the program. They have about six who are voting this week to do some planning around the program. And so that's a school-by-school thing. However, in Waseca, when they were going to do it school-by-school, that did not work well because the Education Minnesota said you can't pay additional money to some of your teachers and not all of your teachers. And so then they had to have all district votes about implementing TAP instead of a school-by-school vote. So it kind of varies depending on the district and mm-hmm. how it would be funded long-term is mm-hmm. through the proposed monies on alternative comp.
Okay. And in Minneapolis, they are allowing it to go school by school, and there's just a vote within the school?
At this point, that is true. Okay. I can say that in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. the teachers' union has taken a lot of leadership around how this could look long-term, and they're looking at something about phasing out teachers would make a choice to be on whatever you want to call it, quality comp, alternative comp, pro-pay, whatever, or the old salary schedule, and then they would have to look at it within individual schools. Once they voted to go on TAP, they would be voting to go with an alternative comp.
All right. Representative Dorn.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize if you covered this earlier, but I had to step out of the room and work on my coughing spell. One of the questions is just for quick comparability, the $225 of the governor's proposal, how does that compare to the funding that Waseca, say, received in order to do the TAP? I recall the superintendent mentioning $2.6 million of the Milken money. What does that break down to per student there?
Waseca could easily do the program at the Milken recommended rate of $400 per student. That grant more than covers them for 2 years, and actually they're hoping to be able to have some of that grant money to continue the program beyond the 2 years. So $400 per student is what is the recommended amount of funding according to the TAP program.
And Madam Chair, then that's roughly what Waseca received for what we're going to see next week was
yes.
about four.
Yes.
And then, Madam Chair, if I might, and maybe you covered it, is the $225 in the governor's proposal, is that capped in some way, or is that available for whatever districts become eligible by putting in the components?
As far as I understand it, Representative Dorn, it would be first come, first served. So the first districts that want to do the program and are willing to meet those okay. criteria would be the first ones that would have access to that money, and that would be $225. When I went to the seminar in Colorado that they had on this, and it was in pretty much 2.5 solid days of learning about this, I found out that not all states are spending $400 a student. It does vary somewhere between $200 and $400. I didn't hear of anybody going over $400, but there were, you know, some in other areas. So I think the governor is thinking the $225 plus some of the staff development money, that's really what we're talking about is staff development, mm-hmm. would also become available for something like that. But, you know, I think a lot will depend on the plan that each school district comes up with, because this is not a mandate of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
This is, if you think this sounds good for your area and you want to do it, mm-hmm. Then, you know, you have to kind of work up the plan. But the Milken Foundation would help provide that training. And I think that's one of the real assets of using that plan is you get some excellent training.
So, Madam Chair, then there is some kind of cap down the line, even in the governor's proposal.
If people sign on to this and go ahead and do it and are doing it well, that one way or another, we're going to maintain that funding. Okay. Because I think you're going to see results that will make it something people want to do.
Okay. And do we have time? Can I ask another question? Do we have a little more time?
Oh, go ahead. Ask another one.
And my question really is, when we're in Waseca, and I appreciated the breakdown of the agenda, sometimes when I'm hearing all of this, it sounds like pieces of it would work, in my mind, better at the elementary level than the secondary level. I think sometimes it's hard for me to see how you track performance given the breakup of the secondary schedule. And so just kind of the general question is, have they learned some things about those differences between elementary or middle school or senior high school that we should be on the lookout for, or that could help us better understand how all this might go?
Ms. Baker.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Waseca High School sees themselves as kind of the poster child for how this program may work at the high school level. You're right. At the elementary level, it's easier to attribute student gain to individual students. At the secondary level, if it's a middle school, that still is a whole lot easier than once you get to a high school level. At the high school level, currently we are looking at only math and reading games. And so the only teachers that are getting a bonus based on individual student gains are English teachers and math teachers. All of the other teachers in school, 50% of their bonus is based on their own performance through evaluation, and 50% of the bonus is based on school-wide gains. So being able to track that at high school is a more difficult process. I will tell you that one of the things that they've begun to work on at the high school in Waseca is their cluster groups meet around higher level questioning and higher order thinking skills with kids. What is really good about that particular focus is that, number one, it was supported by their data, that this was a need that they identified in their student test data. But more, and secondly, and less important but also important, is that applies to all content areas. Whether even if you're the Phi-Ed teacher, you can look at ways that you can use compare, contrast, inferencing, and other higher order thinking skills with kids.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Baker, do you think there's an advantage to a district such as Waseca, because it's a smaller setting, to being district-wide as compared to Minneapolis, which has a lot of school buildings being sites?
Ms. Baker.
Thank you. I think in a small district like Waseca, to have the program district-wide is far preferable to having individual schools go and do it. However, I will say that across the country, most of what's happening is that they are individual sites that have done it. So I think it can be done both ways. I will say that there's a really good coming together of the Waseca education community because it's K-12. And, in fact, the master teachers from all of the schools meet together and share, you know, common problems and so on and so forth. So it makes it nice when it's all district.
Oh, if we share one follow-up.
One follow-up.
You know, Ms. Baker, the advantage I can see there of what you've just described is that teachers then get ready for the next levels. As high school teachers listen to elementary teachers, they're more in tune to what's going to be happening as these children come to their level. And that kind of camaraderie and collegiality is essential, again, I think, to student learning.
Well, even within schools, that is happening. You know, for example, we don't start testing children with the MCA until third grade. But within those clusters, they're saying, you know what, if we're going to get them to third grade here, then they got to be here by the end of second, and here by the end of first, and here, by the way, by the end of kindergarten. And that has been a real powerful professional development piece for Waseca.
And, Madam Chair, one last question. What I think...
I thought your last one was one last question.
Because under the TAT model and the multiple career paths requiring increasing levels of responsibilities, you know, under the single career path, everything is the same. But here, for example, I heard you mention this morning, and maybe you repeated it again this afternoon, I didn't catch it, but teachers are responsible for tracking the testing of their students. And, you know, that's always been a piece that I have found missing within a school district or within a building, within a site, is that we didn't all track the testing of our students. So I didn't have conversations necessarily with the teachers who taught different English courses about what the progress of these students might have been. But now they have to. And that's really, really going to help.
Yeah. I think we'll have one more question, and that will be Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Baker, what would happen if the money ran out that the governor was allocating, but more districts wanted to participate, and so they tried to do it on the cheap? Do you have any research on that, you know, how that would impact their ability to have that kind of student achievement?
Ms. Baker.
Thank you. Actually, the TAP program itself has research that basically shows that the more fully the complete TAP program is implemented and the more it's done in a quality way, the more the student achievement gains are noted. And it's like anything else. You can have the best program in the world, and if it's implemented in a sloppy way, you're not going to get much. And that's why they do, Milken conducts program reviews, and they go out and do a thorough investigation of how thoroughly and how true to the program things are implemented. If a district tried to do it on the cheap, my guess is they would probably have some of the components. They might not have all of the components. The training element is so key and critical, because if you don't get that, you tend to do business as usual. So I think it would be difficult, but it's not impossible for a district to say, you know what, we want to have our own plan for putting these same components into place. What would be important, I think, is for someone to be monitoring that. There has to be some accountability, because simply saying you're doing it and really doing it are two different things.
Thank you.
To that point, Representative Clemzing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Baker, for the schools that are implementing TAP, how have their other staff development programs changed? Have they completely exchanged those for TAP? Because it sounds like TAP's so time intensive that I'm not sure I'd have a lot of time to run off to a workshop on five other things.
Their professional development has changed dramatically. Instead of having whole group presentations on topic A during staff development days, cluster groups meet during staff development days. And so the professional development is, again, targeted to the needs of the kids and the needs of the groups. I think I mentioned Beverly Shower's research, that going off to workshops or classes, you implement about 5%. If you have all the components of TAP, the implementation level is 90 to 95%. It's a significantly better way of doing professional development. And what I have seen in the schools is that, yes, they do begin to use their professional development dollars in a more targeted way and much more tied to the cluster group and the follow-up classroom coaching.
So given the $225 plus the professional development set aside and the Title II funds, probably schools would not be in a position to do it on the cheap. They'd really be in the position to do it in a quality way and implement it in a quality way.
That's what we hope.
All right, thank you. You know, I think many of your questions will be answered when we actually go to Waseca and see the program. And I was thinking maybe in the bus on the way back we could do a little debriefing and talk about what we think we saw and how other people saw it, et cetera, et cetera. So we could have some fun with it on the way back. But at this point, we need to go on to No Child Left Behind. Ms. Baker, thank you so much. This was a little more time than I expected you to take this afternoon, especially after this morning. But I appreciate it, and we all appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we have, to give us an update on No Child Left Behind, we have Paul Magnuson from the Department of Education. And you know, in the past, I think Jessie Montano has been the deputy commissioner who has been here, and she's away on a family emergency. So we have the privilege of Mr. Magnuson today.
Good
Mm-hmm. And can I guess that this is Mr. Shepherd? All right, wonderful. Mr. Shepherd is the principal at Dayton's Bluff Achievement Plus Elementary School in the St. Paul School District. And so he is here to give us more of a first-hand feeling of what's going on with No Child Left Behind. Mr. Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for having us here today. I'd like to start with Vaughn Shepherd. It's a little bit out of the order of what I had planned, but given the time where we are right now. And what is our time window for the afternoon?
You have until 2:15.
Okay, so if we could start with Principal Shepherd, and so tell us a little bit about the school and their efforts of reform working at the school, and I'm sure they'll be open for questions.
Okay, Madam Chair, committee members. Again, my name is Vaughn Shepherd. I'm the principal at Dayton Bluff Achievement Plus Elementary School. 3 years ago, our school was restructured. A third of the staff was hired back. 92% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch. There was about 50% mobility. 46% of our kids are African American. 26% are Asian. 15% are Hispanic. 13% are white. And 2% are Native American. 37% of our kids are ELL. And about 35% of our kids are special ed. And I'm sure all of you would agree that education is not what it used to be. I think this government and this world have requirements of proficiency and standards. And this No Child Left Behind Act has made all of us accountable. And even our teachers accountable. So each of our teachers have an individual education plan for every student in their classroom. You know, it's interesting. When I first started this job, there were a lot of negative issues surrounding of a school. And one of the things that I had to deal with right away was creating a positive working environment, or positive environments for teachers to be able to teach and students to be able to learn. So I had to make the environment safe. And in doing that, teachers were able to teach. The students at Dayton's Bluff come in many different forms. There are a lot of issues of homelessness, kids that don't have fathers, and I'm in a situation, being an African-American male, and most of our issues of discipline were around African-American males. In the beginning, I was able to kind of bridge that gap because they weren't able to get away with some of the things that they were able to get away with some of the other teachers and staff members. One of the things I focused on right away was to change the thinking of the staff and the community and the teachers in that building. I told them we first had to care and believe in these kids before they would allow us to teach them. One of the things we started to do right away was to use data, the test data, the information that we received when teachers did running records, in order to drive instruction in our building. We also used learning walks to drive professional development in our building. And this was information that our teachers received based on their professional development training from the district, as well as from my district and literacy coordinators. And we use this information to observe, to monitor, and use for monthly expectations for our teachers. When I look back in the last 3 years at Dayton's Bluff, and I tell you, I am so proud of the teachers and the commitment that our teachers have given in that school. When we first started out on this venture, our superintendent gave us support. Superintendent Harvey, had it not been for her support and the district office support, our school would have been doomed. So I think it's crucial for districts and people such as yourself, because we received external help from the State Department right away. And they provided us with two principals from the State Department of Education. And although there were some issues in the beginning, they were crucial and instrumental in helping us drive our building in the right direction, and ultimately helping me as an instructional leader in our building. So if you have any influence at all in the decision-making as far as funding is concerned, or you know people that are going to make those decisions, let them know that we need financial support. Because without that support, I cannot continue doing what we're doing at Dayton's Bluff.
Are there any questions? I would certainly be curious to know, what have you seen in the way of academic changes at Dayton's Bluff?
The students are more focused. The teachers have professional development, in-house professional development from my design and literacy coach that they've received from the district office and from America's Choice. That's our reform model. The students now believe that they can achieve, and this has happened over a period of time. We first got our test results. I think everybody was kind of in shock, including myself, because I didn't know that we were going to do as well. In 3 years, we have taken our kids from being 20% at or above standard in year 2001 to 76% of our students being at or above standard today. And we constantly look at data to drive instruction in our building. We have a design leadership team that meets every Wednesday morning at 7 o'clock. And we look at student work, keeps us on our toes. We look at ways of improving, you know, as far as looking at the test data and figuring out different strategies that teachers can use in order to improve their instruction. Like I said, we have on-site professional development that has really taken our students to the next level as far as achievement is concerned.
Thank you very much. Representative Griling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but Principal, if you could you tell me what percentage of the students at Dayton's Bluff go to early childhood programs, and do you see that that makes a huge difference by the time they get to your school?
You know, we just started a four-year-old program.
Mr. Shepherd.
So time will tell. I know we have a UCFE program in our building, and unfortunately, a lot of those students come from, we're a neighborhood school, they come from outside of our area, so they end up going to the neighborhood school or a school that where they can be bused at.
So in a few years, you might be able to give us a little update on the four-year-old program. Okay. Representative Meslow.
Mr. Shepherd, you also talked about how at the beginning you had significant staff turnover. I think you said your retention was only about 33%. What's happened with the staff retention since you've been going forward with these plans?
Mr. Shepherd.
We've had no turnover in our building in the last 3 years. Teachers want to stay there. And one of the things that I tell other principals when I speak is that if you want teaching superstars, you have to treat them like teaching superstars. I have fortunate enough that I'm in control of my budget. So when teachers come after the summer, they have their materials and supplies waiting for them in the library. The only thing they have to worry about is teaching. And they have some of the best professional development that money can buy.
Go on. I don't have any other questions at the moment.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have two short presentations, one on funding, one on programming. I'll stick with the programming piece first. I'm happy to take questions along the way. I understand you're not shy about asking questions.
Mr. Shepherd, thank you so much.
The Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 is what of course is driving IESA and MCLB, MCLB being the current reauthorization. In 65, when the program started, the accountability, and the word accountability referred to the funding and tracking the funds and so forth. Over the years, with the various reauthorizations since then, accountability has moved away from tracking funds to tracking student results. The assumption was at the beginning that of the program in 65, additional funds alone would be the measure that would indeed make a difference. But tracking student performance, we know now, is as important, if not more important. The trouble with a program that started out tracking dollars and those students who were eligible is that the type of programming that resulted from the program was one in which the students, the dollars followed the students, so the students often ended up in pull-out programs out of the mainstream to receive what was often remedial instruction. The focus of the reauthorization before NCLB and even more so of NCLB is a school-wide, whole school reform effort to make sure that all students are doing well and that pull-out programs aren't the only model of choice. For AYP, and much of this presentation is about specifically the adequate yearly progress of schools that are being listed either as not making adequate yearly progress for 1 year or if it's for two consecutive years being listed as a school in need of improvement. Under the reauthorization before NCLB, we had Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, MCAs, at the third and fifth grade level in math and reading. In each of those groups, in the third grade math group, the third grade reading group, fifth grade math, and so forth, each of those groups needed to make adequate yearly progress for the school then to make adequate yearly progress. We had three different categories of results. They were either not making sufficient progress, that's 1 year of not making progress in one of those groups, needs assistance was two consecutive years, or multi-year needs assistance, which wasn't defined further than you're still working on trying to turn the school around. NCLB tightened that up quite a bit and added quite a bit to it. There are more subgroups. There are tests in more grades. And the AYP status, or the whether or not a school or a district is meeting AYP, now refers both to title schools and to non-title schools, so that every school or every entity actually in the state that has a school code number that's considered a school gets an AYP status. I have some figures on where we are right now with our number of schools being identified. We've got 1,969 schools, and these are including elementary, middle, junior high, what we traditionally think of as schools, charter schools, alternative learning programs, alternative learning centers. Of those schools, 471 did not make AYP, either for 1 year, or it might have been their second consecutive year, or third year, and so forth. The consequences of No Child Left Behind only apply to those schools that receive Title I Part A funds. 862 of those schools are title schools. 188 of them did not make AYP. And 48 of them have not made AYP somewhere in their recent past for two consecutive years. So once a school does not make adequate yearly progress for two consecutive years, it's titled as in need of improvement or needs improvement, and it's at that point that the state begins working more directly with a school. We'll talk a little bit more later about what that programs are like, but that's what Vaughn was referring to.
Mr. Magnuson,
yes.
When you talk about schools that didn't make AYP, was Principal Shepherd's one of those that had not made AYP for a couple of years?
Madam.
And where is his school at now? From the sound of things, he must have pulled out of that.
Madam Chair, that's correct. He, let's take a look.
I didn't think of it. I should have asked him while he was here. But
no, that's fine. For the last 2 years, every one of the subgroups of this in Dayton's Bluff has met adequate yearly progress. So 2 years in a row, that got them back off of the list, so they're no longer on any sort of watch list or needs improvement list at all. Previous to those 2 years, they had been on the list for 2 years in a row.
And of our schools that had been on the list, do we have many others who are no longer AYP schools?
Madam Chair, I would have had the possibility to invite some other principals, but not very many. Yeah.
So I think I had heard 65 schools came off AYP over the past year.
Let me move to my next slide.
Okay.
Or two slides, and I think I'm getting it. What new with NCLB is that districts too, and for that matter the state, but districts too have to have an AYP status, and either they make or do not make AYP. We have 370 districts, that's not counting charter schools. They're treated as schools for this purpose. 150 of those districts did not make AYP for the first time with our AYP 04. 17 of those districts had not met now AYP for two consecutive years, and they're also in a needs improvement status and then have some additional work to do with school reform planning with the State Department. Here's my number. 64 schools that did not make AYP in 03 made it in 2004.
64.
And 5 schools that were in needs improvement status came off of that list. Dayton's Bluff being one of them. There's 4 other principals out there that I could have invited today. Okay, that's as a way of background where we are right now. For our AYP 05 calculation, which is the school year 2004-2005, MCAs are given, the tests that this is based on are given in April and May. Each year we have the opportunity, it appears anyway, to update what our business rules are for actually determining the AYP status. There was a flurry of guidance from the feds last year regarding flexibility and how we could go about changing some of those elements of our business rules called flexibility. So no changes in the law, of course, but some interpretations that differed from what previously had been given out by U.S. Department of Education. We adopted many different changes. There's two significant ones that we're adopting now for 2005, and these are approved by USAID and part of our programming. Each cell, there's 9 different subgroups for under known child left behind that need to make adequate yearly progress. They need to make it in participation on the test and proficiency on the tests, and that's both for reading and math. So 9 times 2 times 2, there's a lot of different subgroups that need to make adequate yearly progress. One of those subgroups is for LEP, or limited English proficient students. We are moving our minimum cell size, the cell size at which we say that this group counts towards that AYP identification, from 20 to 40. It'll match then special ed at 40. All of the other subgroups remain at 20. So we have a different minimum cell size for LEP for next year. We're also looking at changing how we are running the proficiency calculation. And we're going to do something that was allowed last year. We did not do it last year. We'll do it this year. It's very close to how we did the participation calculation, which was also a change that we adopted last year. So it'll bring participation and proficiency as the two calculations in sync. For both participation and proficiency for AYP 05, the test scores that the students take in 2004-2005 are first considered by themselves, and either the school or the district does or does not make AYP. If the school or district doesn't make AYP based on this year's test scores, then the calculation automatically goes back and looks and combines this year's scores with the previous year's scores and runs the calculation again. After that calculation, if the school or district doesn't make AYP, the calculation will go back and do one more calculation, including this year, the previous year, and the year previous to that. This addresses some concerns that if a particular class is, and we know this, is this happens, that a particular class tends to be academically scoring higher, but if they're a small enough number, that the calculation can wobble a bit year from year. It takes a little bit of that wobble out. It also addresses if a particular family were to go on vacation that takes their 2 kids with that are high-scoring kids or low-scoring kids for that matter and changes the calculation. The change will not make it any harder for any school or district to make AYP. The change can only make it easier to make AYP. And then as we plan for next year, we have, like everywhere, a certain number of staff and a certain number of staffing hours and so forth, yet we have requirements under No Child Left Behind of providing technical assistance to all those schools and districts that need technical assistance under the law. We have 48 schools this year that are receiving assistance from the department and with our structure. There's 9 of them that made AYP last year. So there's potentially 9 schools next year that can come off of the list altogether. That leaves us with 39 schools that we know for sure are on our list next year, because they'll either be in an advanced stage under No Child Left Behind, or they will be they'll be waiting one more year to get off the list. The maximum number of schools that we're looking at for next year is 197, which is going to test our capacity to be able to provide the assistance that they need. Von Shepherd mentioned that he had 2 former principals come out, work with him. It's a 2-year plan that the schools create. They get a fair amount of assistance and beyond just the 2 principals. That's going to be difficult as we get more schools on the list, if that's what happens. Districts, we have 17 currently on the list. They have to have 2 years of making AYP to come off the list. So those 17 that are on the list this year, we know for sure are on the list next year. And we've got 133 other districts that did not make AYP for the first time, so we could be looking at upwards of 150 districts that require technical assistance next year. The point under No Child Left Behind of having a structure which gives some sort of AYP status to the school and district isn't merely punitive. The idea is that a school or district that is not making whatever the state sets as its proficiency bar and what the state sets as its percentage of students that need to be scoring proficient and so forth, schools and districts below that mark are those that should receive the most amount of assistance to improve. There are consequences for that, both with the programs and the budget. In general, the budget consequences as schools are ramped up through each year of stages are some less flexibility about how they spend their funds. At the school level, removing of some of the flexibility is usually a set-aside requirement for professional development. At the district level, there's also, when a district is identified, a set-aside requirement for professional development, 10% of the Title I funds. And at the school level, there's also the 20% set-aside of their Title I Part A funds for school choice and supplemental services. So as the schools move and as the districts move through the stages under No Child Left Behind, what's taken away is some of the flexibility that NCLB also affords students and schools.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the testifier, I'm very interested in the supplemental services that you just mentioned for a school that needs to make progress. I think particularly of our schools in Greater Minnesota, which might not have some of the resources that I'm aware of that could be used for tutoring, like Sylvan, in the metro area. To what sort of resources might a rural school turn?
Madam Chair, Representative
Magnuson.
Supplemental services are the requirement when a school has not made AYP for either 3 years in a row or didn't make AYP for 2 years in a row, made AYP for a year, and then did not make AYP again. It does require a 20% set-aside. Part of it is for transportation. At least 5% is still for transportation at first consequence, and then 5 to 15% of that remaining 20% is for supplemental services. It is an issue in Greater Minnesota when supplemental services need to be advertised by the district, yet there may not be a provider in the area. The online provider, if there is one, might not be an appropriate choice for some of the students. And I'd say we've had varying results with providers across the state.
So, Mr. Magnuson, are you saying right now there aren't providers across the state?
Well, Madam Chair, the providers are probably weighted more towards being in the metro area. It's relying on some market competition for those providers who want to become providers. They submit an application through an application process to the Minnesota Department of Education. they're reviewed and they either become an approved provider or not. They're approved for 3 years. Their providers are likely going to establish themselves where they're going to get the most students. We're going to see the most providers in the metro area. It's a problem not just for Minnesota but for other states to work on how do you get adequate providers for those students who want supplemental services in greater Minnesota, and how do you assure that the quality of those supplemental service providers isn't weaker merely because it's in greater Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a follow-up to the question, if there are schools who are needing those services now, what are they doing in greater Minnesota, right, my special interest?
Mr. Magnuson.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative, I understand that there are online programs available or that there are providers available in some spaces, some places. A provider can be an individual person. It can be an organization, whether it be a church or a community organization, or the school district itself. I think that we'll see a lot of the supplemental service providers actually be districts as districts apply themselves.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Magnuson, is it federal law that says that the state is the only one who can approve providers of supplemental services, or it's state, or is it state policy which says that?
Mr. Magnuson.
That is the federal law. The state has to approve the providers.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Magnuson, is this an opportunity for retired teachers to offer their services? And also, isn't this an opportunity for our regional educational centers? In my area, we have Resources and Solutions out of St. Cloud. I've noticed on their material that they distribute to us that they have a wonderful array of services that I would suspect could be supplemental to some of those districts that are not as close to St. Cloud, but for whom their staff would provide some training, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Mr. Magnuson.
Representative, that is the intention, that it be an opportunity for those who are qualified and are interested to throw their hats in the ring, so to say, be approved and have an approved program, and then work with those students who need the help. Part of the approval process is, I'm going to run out of total detail here, but part of the approval process is being able to demonstrate that the services that are provided are aligned with the state standards. So it has to be in sync with what's being taught in the school.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Magnuson. Sorry. In response to Representative Johnson's first question, you indicated that the department was having problems with inconsistent performance from the supplemental service providers, as I understand. Perhaps you implied. You did imply something about performance issues with supplemental service providers. Can you speak more fully, please?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Mr. Magnuson.
Representative, yes. Anytime you have a pool of different providers providing service, you're obviously going to have some sort of range of quality in those providers. We're pretty new in this process still, and I guess what I'm implying there is, yes, I've heard as I work with those schools, and I head up the team of people that works with the schools identified for AYP and the districts identified under AYP, I've heard of instances where my staff is out in the field working with a school, and sometimes the reports about the quality of the supplemental services being provided make us raise our eyebrows a little bit. Yeah, it's something that we need to stay on top of to ensure the quality.
Follow up,
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. At this point, it sounds then like your data is anecdotal. At which point, I'm not sure it's data, but your information is anecdotal. What structures does MDE have in place for monitoring the performance of supplemental service providers? Alignment with state standards, such alike.
Mr. Magnuson.
Representative, the structure on the front end is an application process that's reviewed by teams of people both inside and outside of the department to attest to the quality of the program and so forth. And it's been a fairly rigorous process, probably less than 50% actually being approved. That's on the front end. And then they're only approved for 3 years. They have to go through that process again in 3 years. During that time frame within the 3 years, there's an evaluation that comes to the state, but as detail as what's in that evaluation and how strong an evaluation that is, I don't know. But it is possible for the state to say to a provider that you're no longer approved.
All right, are there any other further questions from members of the committee? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the provider issue, I had the same one Representative Dabney had about the evaluation process. So, Mr. Magnuson, you're saying that there is an actual evaluation process in place right now that the state has on the supplemental service providers?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Mr. Magnuson.
Representative, I believe there is a process in place for evaluating, and it's this is anecdotal, but I believe it is getting stronger as we go, as we hear some of the news from the field.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Magnus, do you know what branch of the department that evaluation is under? Is it under Choice and Innovation? Is it under NCLB? What branch? If I wanted to go find out this information, where would I go?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Magnuson.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not within our NCLB programs. It's within the school choice area. The director is Morgan Brown, and I'd suggest asking him what the process is there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we have session at 3. Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Oh, are you finished? I'm sorry, I thought you were, but asked so many questions. And then started asking so many questions. Did you have something left, Mr. Magnuson, that you'd like to say? Please be our guest.
Madam Chair, at least our government is very efficient. But like, that's good. I have about 2 slides of this particular piece. The other piece that I had was the funding levels for estimated for federal fiscal year 2005. You actually have that as a handout, and you can take a look at that. While I'm on that, just to mention, federally, our federal funds under No Child Left Behind have been dropping the last couple of years. They're dropping relative to our proportion of poverty students, according to the census and census updates. We're not competing in poverty the same way some other states are, so we're experiencing a bit of a drop. Our Title I Part A funds, which is over $100 million, dropped about 1.5%. That's not all that much, except for the fact that that drop also then precipitates some drops in other titles, because the other title funding formulas are based in part on that Title I formula. So we've experienced a drop in most every program except, I believe, Title II that was mentioned earlier here is about level funded. Safe and Drug-Free Schools, Title IV, is level funded again. Limited English Proficient Funds under Title III have actually increased about 10%. That was my very quick funding update. Regarding school improvement planning, this is the point of NCLB again. It's not simply to rate schools and then say we're done, that's all there is to it, but it's actually to assist those schools that need that assistance. And as good as our formula is in the state for identifying the correct schools that actually need assistance, then those schools get that assistance. I had one additional handout that has some columns on it of various programs. There's 2 columns for the district, there's 4 columns for schools. Title I has had school-wide improvement plans in place for quite a while. Any school currently that has 40% or greater feed and reduced price lunch qualifies to operate as a school-wide program. part of that is that the school then needs to write a whole school improvement plan and have that updated regularly. We also have programs since 1998 called Comprehensive School Reform, CSR. It was funded back then maybe at $3 or $4 million for Minnesota. It's dropped down to $1.7 million as it seems to be fading from the scene a bit. It was the pillar of whole school reform again under the previous reauthorization and still around a bit. But we have schools that apply for that. It's a competitive grant, and they also need to write school improvement plans. And then finally, we've got those schools for AYP, and the requirement there is that they write a school improvement plan. You can imagine that in the schools that are the most neediest, it's quite possible that they have three different school improvement plans to write. And because these programs have started at different points in time, until this coming year, they have been writing individual plans for each of those programs. Obviously, if a school wants to improve, they need one solid school improvement plan. The other column on there is the district plan. Districts often require plans already. We're working, in fact, we're meeting at 2:30, so if I'm actually almost done, I'll make the next piece here today with a couple of districts to make sure that their school improvement plans are matching our template for the school improvement plans under No Child Left Behind. And we've parceled out the pieces of the law for these various school improvement plans so that we can have one school improvement plan work for the entire school for all of the federal requirements of those programs. Training for that starts in February with them. And then for the district level, we have a district application each year. It's a fairly hefty application for all of these title funds. Fortunately, it's a consolidated application, so it comes from one team in the school, comes to us, and so that the evaluation about what's happening in these federal programs can be centered on not just if the letter of the law is being followed within a certain title, but that the titles themselves are supporting each other. It was interesting listening to Marilyn earlier when she's talking about the TAP plan and using Title II dollars. It's the first time that I was able to sit down and hear somebody talk about the TAP plan, and Title II dollars would be appropriate, but it's one of those instances where our department needs to have the different ends speaking together, so we really work that out, and then it works nicely. The district application that we set up for ESEA funds is structured in such a way that it is already a district-wide improvement plan. NCLB now will require districts to do improvement plans, and they differ slightly, but we're working again to make sure that the original district application for NCLB also matches the improvement plans required for ESA funds, also matches the improvement plan, so it's not an additional load on districts, nor do districts end up with multiple plans. I think I can stop there.
Now are there any other questions? I apologize, Mr. Magnuson. I just forgot that we hadn't finished. We will, we may have you back later in the year, too, just depending on what we're looking at with regards to No Child Left Behind. But in the meantime, I thank you very much for being here. And members, please take a look at the minutes. And while you're looking at the minutes, remember that Greg's daughters are selling Girl Scout cookies. And if you wish to sign up, it's at the front desk. Anybody? Representative Briling?
I have that first, please.
Ah. All right, Representative Briling, buy cookies. Representative Biskins moved the minutes. Are there any corrections, additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved, and we'll see you next week. Meeting is adjourned.